Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're as guilty of it as anybody, trying to make heads or tails of what the market's doing, then summing it up in a line or two. Stocks did this today, or investors thought that this week. It can be tricky sometimes, but on days like this, why, it's a piece of cake. Two stocks, 100-point gain in the Dow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us today. It's February 13th. Stock number one on this Tuesday is one of 30 companies making up the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It's also the subject of a serious rumor campaign. Add those two things together and the Dow's usually off and running. Shares in Alcoa were up 7% at the opening bell this morning. The jump followed a newspaper report two mining companies wanted to buy the aluminum producer. One of those companies has denied the report. The other's not talking, but investors weren't listening anyway. Marketplace's Amy Scott takes it from there.
The British paper The Times reported today that two Australian mining companies were each preparing $40 billion bids for Alcoa. They are BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto. Alcoa looks like an appealing target. Its earnings rose 75% last year, thanks in part to the rise in commodity prices. But its stock hasn't kept pace. That makes it a relatively cheap acquisition. Industry analyst Chuck Bradford is skeptical. He says neither mining company has expressed interest in the so-called downstream side of the business. That involves making products like the aluminum sheets used in soda cans.
Unless they could find a buyer, which is possible, for Alcoa's downstream business, which includes aerospace alloys and a number of other things, I don't think it's too likely.
Analyst Scott Burns with Morningstar disagrees. He says he thought the Russian aluminum producer Rusal might make a move for Alcoa, partly because of that downstream business.
Every year over the past 30 years, there's more aluminum in cars and less steel. There's more aluminum being used in the beverage and food packaging industry and not less. So I think if anyone were to acquire it, acquiring those contracts and contacts would be one of the big reasons to do so.
Another aluminum deal this week may have fueled speculation about Alcoa. Sunday, the Indian producer Hindalco announced it would buy Canadian company Novelis for $3.5 billion. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I promised you two stocks. General Motors is the second, also a Dow component. GM was up almost 2.5%. Analyst upgrade by Merrill Lynch. Financial services companies had a pretty good day today, too. Not quite Alcoa-like, but more up than down. U.S. banks have been trying to tap into the Hispanic population as a new source of revenue. By some estimates, half of the nation's 40 million or so Latinos don't have bank accounts. And Bank of America is just the latest to roll out Hispanic-targeted services. But the Wall Street Journal reports today it's the first to go after a specific part of that market. Marketplace's Sam Eaton has the story.
Bank of America has been offering credit cards to its Los Angeles area customers who have bank accounts but little credit history. The move is aimed at drawing more business from the city's large Hispanic population. But critics claim it's also lending a helping hand to undocumented immigrants. Bank of America says it requires customers to prove that they pay taxes in the U.S., but federal law states that citizenship or legal status isn't required to open accounts. BOA's approach goes beyond that of other banks like Wells Fargo that have targeted checking accounts and mortgages specifically to Hispanics. Banking consultant Bert Ely says there's a reason for that. Banks aren't allowed to control more than 10% of the nation's total deposits.
They are now forced, because of the 10% cap, to rely largely on organic growth or internal growth to build their customer base.
Banks aren't the only ones that stand to gain. Robert Gnezda is with the Greenlining Institute.
Any efforts that bring people from outside the underground into the regular economy have enormous incremental benefit to the society as a whole.
At least half of the 40 million Hispanics living in the U.S. don't have bank accounts, but the group's purchasing power is close to $1 trillion a year. Small wonder Bank of America plans to take its credit card program nationwide. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Ever have one of those outings where you get the bill later on and you wonder whether it was worth it? Pat Loeb reports now regulators have fined three mutual fund companies a total of $700,000 for trying to win business with expensive meals and fancy trips.
Alliance Bernstein Putnam and Scudder Investments were fined for violating rules against non-cash compensation that could improperly influence brokers. NASD says the three funds held perfectly permissible education sessions, then spiced them up with perks that violated the rules. Alliance Bernstein bought tickets to Broadway shows for brokers and their guests. Putnam paid for spouses to travel and treated them to Red Sox games. Scudder arranged golf, fishing, and horseback riding and threw a party recreating the legendary Hollywood bar Whiskey A Go-Go.
That's the kind of thing that really doesn't belong in the mix.
Jim Shores is the executive vice president and head of enforcement for NASD. He says these kinds of favors might lead brokers to recommend the funds out of gratitude instead of the soundness of the investment.
If the investing public were to lose faith in our industry, that could be absolutely devastating.
Putnam released a statement saying it stopped the practice as soon as it learned it was illegal. The other two firms did not return requests for comment. In Los Angeles, I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
We ought to tell you one of the companies Pat was telling you about, Putnam, is one of the underwriters of this program. We told you about the Dow already. The S&P and the NASDAQ were up, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's another record, but not necessarily the good kind. The Commerce Department told us this morning the trade deficit grew by 6.5% last year. Here's the record part. We bought $764 billion more stuff from overseas than we sold. By far the biggest chunk of that money, $233 billion to be exact, is our trade gap with China. Deficits with the EU and Japan are pretty fat, too. Congressional Democrats sent a letter to the president today calling for tougher trade policies to bring down the trade imbalance. But commentator and economist Marcellus Andrews says the only people we should be tough on are ourselves.
Average Americans don't see much of a problem when they buy cheap Chinese goods from Best Buy or Walmart. How can buying cheap DVDs, TVs, CDs, and other gadgets be a bad thing? But the harsh fact of economic life is that because Americans keep buying more from China than we sell to China, our standard of living must go down. Here's how it'll happen. There are 1.3 billion Chinese just as smart as we are. Their low wages are a road to riches for them and a road to ruin for thousands of us. As a result, Chinese banks are flooded with dollars. The Chinese are sitting on well over a trillion of them. What can Chinese banks and businesses buy with dollars in China? Not much. But they can lend us money. Every time you use your credit card, think dollars courtesy of China. Since Americans spend $1.01 for every dollar we earn, we have to borrow the difference from somewhere. Chinese banks have money to lend American banks, who in turn finance credit card purchases and mortgages and much else. The Chinese will eventually stop lending us dollars they earn selling us more stuff than we sell them. It'll happen pretty soon, too. See, households are starting to max out on the credit cards. Mortgage defaults are up, and they're likely to shoot up further now that the housing bubble has popped. Chinese banks will start trading dollars for other currencies and start spending their dollars on other investments, like U.S. businesses and very valuable property. In other words, the Chinese will figure it's better to end up owning an even larger piece of America than to lend spendthrift Americans money. I worry we'll only wake up when our banker, China, cuts off our national credit card and thus slices our high living. Then we'll get bellicose and blame the Chinese for what we've wrought. And we'll be flat out wrong.
Economist Marcellus Andrews lives in New York City. You know where to find us. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says contact. Everybody from the president on down is praising the news out of Beijing today. North Korea has agreed to suspend its nuclear program in exchange for a $250 million aid package. One sticking point both sides have agreed to leave for later is whether Pyongyang gets its hands on millions of dollars sitting in a bank in Macau. University of Georgia history professor Stephen Mims says a lot has to happen before the U.S. unfreezes that money.
If in the next month this question of the frozen accounts is resolved to their satisfaction, and that's a big if, then that may do a lot to ensure the success of this particular accord. But it's by no means certain.
The big geopolitical news is happening in Beijing, but down in Shanghai, there's a huge corruption scandal unfolding. The city's former Communist Party chief's under investigation for looting a pension fund. And police are investigating employees of seven multinational companies, including McDonald's and Whirlpool, for accepting bribes. Suspicion is they took $500,000 in kickbacks. In most countries, scandal's bad for business. But Jocelyn Ford reports that sometimes being on the up and up means lost business.
I wanted to welcome everybody to today's event.
It's 7:30 on a Sunday morning. The general manager of a Beijing English-language city magazine is herding a group of advertisers onto a bus. They're going on an all-expenses-paid trip to the ski slopes.
Our biggest reason, actually, to take everyone here to Nanshan is to have some fun and get to know you guys. A lot of you guys are clients of ours.
Manager Mike Wester says the thrifty ski trip is a good way to get to know clients. He doesn't allow his ad staff to lure customers with kickbacks, even though that's common practice in the magazine industry, as Wester learned early on.
You know, one time when we first started out, this guy pulled us aside from a real estate company and he said, "You guys are fools. Look at this sales kit."
It gave the actual price of an ad, and the advertiser said it was way too low.
I'm telling you, you know what you need to do? Make it 10 times that. But when you come to sell me an ad, give me 50% off, first of all. Then give me a massive kickback. And I'm going to book ads like crazy. He's like, "That's the way it works, don't you know? Don't you understand?" And we were kind of like, "Oh my God, what have we gotten ourselves into?"
At That's Beijing magazine, Wester has a zero-tolerance rule for ad sales staff who are tempted by kickbacks. So far, he's only had to fire one person. But at larger corporations, policing employees is a bigger challenge.
Most multinationals in China suffer from a horrendous amount of employee corruption and petty fraud.
Peter Humphrey is a corporate investigator. Over the past 9 years, his company has handled more than 500 cases in China. He's done investigations for just about every multinational operating here.
Most of it involves kickbacks taken from suppliers across the board in every imaginable industry, every imaginable thing that a company might need to buy in China.
Humphrey says a lot of the foul play goes unnoticed by foreign executives, especially if the foreigners don't speak Chinese.
Maybe you have an American company running a big factory with 2,000 people, and what happens is that there's a lot going on beneath the surface that they don't notice. The Chinese staff all know what's going on. They gossip about it in their canteens and so on. They all know, but the expatriate management usually do not know.
Until, for example, there's a company audit, or a whistleblower sends an anonymous email or fax. Humphrey says that's what happened in the recent case of the seven multinationals whose employees were caught. Corporations like McDonald's and Japan's Fuji Xerox might be embarrassed by the investigation, but Humphrey says it's good news the police are finally starting to enforce the law against kickbacks. Meanwhile, executives like Mike Wester and his ad sales staff continue to pay a price for following the law.
They will occasionally run into an advertiser who says, "All right, what's the deal? How much are you going to give me as a kickback?" So we don't get the client.
But Wester believes the short-term loss is a long-term gain. He'd rather sell ad space to people who believe his readers actually might buy their company's products. He says those people are more likely to come back to advertise issue after issue. In Beijing, I'm Jocelyn Ford for Marketplace.
Coming up, who needs an office?
I don't have an office at all, so I'm 100% mobile. And you have some areas that are designated as collaboration areas, and then other areas are quiet areas.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial sparkled up 102 points today, 0.8% to finish at 12,654. The NASDAQ shined up 9 points, 0.4% to land at 2,459. The S&P 500 glittered up 10 points, that's about 0.75%, weighed in at 1,444 today. 3M unveiled a brontosaurus of a buyback plan. The office supply giant said it will gobble up $7 billion worth of its own stock over the next couple of years. 3M shares posted up 2.5% today. The price was right for Priceline.com. Shares clicked up 10.6% after the online travel agency announced some out-of-this-world quarterly earnings. Playboy Enterprises announced sagging quarterly profits and sales, but there was just no keeping that rabbit down. Shares hopped up more than 3% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices, online at calvert.com. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up tomorrow, Valentine's Day. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for January. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee holds a hearing on overseas sweatshop abuses. And the man responsible for a very romantic amusement park ride was born on February 14, 1859, American engineer George Washington Gale Ferris, inventor of the Ferris wheel, of course. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Most of what we get is emails, not actual letters, but we do get a tremendous amount of spam, too, much like your mailbox at home. How often do you find yourself sifting through the mail, trying to separate the letter from grandma from all the credit card and loan offers? We did a story this month about a new way of lending that's giving banks a run for their money. It's a website called Prosper.com. Borrowers can post their profile and how much they need. Lenders can bid on the amount they want to loan. It sounds innovative enough, but dangerous too, says Judy Tyrer from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
I was intrigued with the story about Prosper.com, but it rapidly turned from a fun idea to outrage. They actually expected me to send my Social Security number and my bank account information. All I could think of was identity theft. And they took how much out of my account and then flew to the Bahamas?
Everybody likes a day off now and then, but for observant Orthodox Jews, a day of rest means just that, rest. No TV, no toaster oven, nothing remotely technological during the Sabbath. Last Friday, we aired a story on some nifty devices designed to work around some of the restrictions that come with observing the religious ritual. Steve Klein in Oak Park, Michigan, says he liked the piece, but wonders why we picked such a bad day to run it.
You scheduled a story about Jewish Sabbath observers to run on the Jewish Sabbath, the one night during the week when we Sabbath observant Orthodox Jews won't be listening to the radio. I know I can listen to it on a later date through your website, but I can't help but think that the story would have been more appropriate to run on some day other than a Friday.
Point taken, Mr. Klein, but here's another option. You could podcast us too, set yourself up with an automatic update, and you wouldn't have to lift a finger. We're hearing reports about global warming practically every day. Part of that discussion's been about alternative energy as one way to fight climate change. Earlier this month, commentator Robert Reich proposed a temporary tax on big oil companies to pay for that research. Heidi Novak from Valley City in Ohio says that's a pretty good idea.
I applaud Mr. Reich's suggestion to impose a temporary windfall profits tax on oil companies to fund research in alternative energy sources. Perhaps such a tax would also put an end to the wildly fluctuating energy prices that have inhibited growth in other sectors of the U.S. economy.
And finally, this clarification on another climate story from a couple of weeks ago. We told you about the American Enterprise Institute offering $10,000 to scientists willing to critique a big United Nations report on global warming. I said AEI is funded by ExxonMobil. It is, but it's also funded by plenty of other companies, and we should have called Exxon for their comment. Keep on sending us your thoughts. Just go to marketplace.org. The link you want says contact. You could have turned on C-SPAN at virtually any point today and seen a variation on a theme. Somebody either for or against the Democratic resolution opposing the president's plans for Iraq. The debate in the House will go on all week, but the business of Congress isn't waiting around. Massachusetts Democrat Ted Kennedy held hearings today on an idea he says is long overdue: paid sick leave. There's no federal requirement for it right now. Democrats argue that's hurting paychecks and the workplace. But Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Work and Family Desk, business groups aren't buying that.
This past November, voters in San Francisco passed a paid sick leave law. At least seven states are considering similar measures. But a federal sick days law may be a tougher sell. Democrats control Congress, barely, and many Republicans and the business lobby oppose the idea on principle.
Small businesses face a lot of challenges.
Mike Shaw lobbies for small business in California.
Government mandates to provide employee benefits of any kind restrict their ability to make business decisions.
Right now, nearly half of American workers get no designated paid sick time. Kennedy's bill would give employees at least 7 days a year. It exempts companies with less than 15 workers. Business advocates warn that if the bill becomes law, tiny companies may cut staff to get that exemption. Bigger ones may not expand because of labor costs. Deja vu, say their opponents in this battle.
These are many of the same arguments we've heard every time we've tried to take a step forward in the workplace.
Women and families advocate Deborah Ness says employees who come to work sick aren't productive anyway, and they just end up infecting their colleagues. She urges American business to think globally.
The top 20 competitive countries in the world, except for the United States, all provide paid sick days to their workers.
Supporters of a federal sick days mandate admit passage will be difficult, but insist there's more energy and momentum on the issue than ever before. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The federal government closed things down early in Washington today. Snow and freezing rains in the forecast, so everybody got to go home at 2 o'clock Eastern time. The work of the markets went on, though. The Securities and Exchange Commission said its computers can keep track of things without the human touch. Much of what we call work, though, still does need people to happen. But offices are changing to accommodate the way we work today. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more.
The old gym might have said, okay, the schema, I might be able to know.
On a bucolic campus outside Richmond, Virginia, the huge financial services company Capital One runs a program called the Future of Work. Some 2,000 employees are trying out the latest theories on what makes work more efficient, attractive, and flexible. The atmosphere is airy and open with lots of sunlight and bright colors. Among the wide spaces of desks and computers are inviting conversation nooks with cushy chairs and coffee tables.
We have a lot of informal space that is home-like, actually, so the furniture is intended to be very comfortable.
My tour guide is Dan Mortensen, Capital One's Senior Vice President for Corporate Real Estate.
One thing that you will probably notice is as you walk through, the place is occupied and busy. We actually have been able to take a space that was built for just over 600 workstations, and we actually have more than 1,000 individuals assigned to this space. In fact, nearly 1,200 people are assigned to a space that's built for just over 600.
One way to save on office space is to encourage employees to work at home or in the field. When they do come in, mobile associates don't have a dedicated office. They take whatever space is available or has been temporarily assigned to the associate's project team. That works for project manager Sue Sunday.
I don't have an office at all, so I'm 100% mobile. And you have some areas that are designated as collaboration areas, where it's fine to talk and it's fine to pull up with your team. And then other areas are quiet areas.
The desks and tables are modular and can be easily reconfigured. The walls between cubicles are low, only waist high. Visually nice, but Mortensen acknowledges not good for privacy or filtering out your neighbor's conversations.
Interestingly enough, though, I believe that the low cube walls actually encourage people to speak more quietly and be more private. So it's interesting, if you're in an environment that has high cube walls, there's the perception that there's more privacy. People tend not to be as considerate. They'll talk more loudly.
Employees participating in the Future of Work experiment say the schedule flexibility more than makes up for the lack of their own space. Rob Keeling is vice president for diversity.
I have a 2-year-old son at home, so being able to leave Capital One at a non-traditional work time, spend some time with him in the afternoon, and then jump back online, I actually find that I work really well in that environment.
The cost of equipping the mobile workforce with high-speed internet connections, BlackBerries, and Wi-Fi-enabled laptops eats into some of the company's real estate savings. And obviously, not all work lends itself to such mobility. Promoters of the new trends are running into resistance from more traditional employees. Prentice Knight is the CEO of CoreNet Global, an association of corporate real estate executives.
Where it's been most difficult among those people who say, I've worked here for years, I've earned that corner office, or I've earned that private space. And then senior management historically has seen that as a way of demonstrating the power. We are an authority. We've got bigger offices. It's in the corner. We've got great views. But that thinking really is going away.
Knight says younger workers take most readily to the new workplace. And back at Capital One, Dan Mortensen says early adoptees are just the people he's looking for.
The ability for future work to support people's individual lifestyles, to provide them with tools and technology to be more effective, leads to increased satisfaction and enhances our ability to attract and retain top talent. It's a good business move for us.
Which means expect some changes coming soon to a cubicle near you. In Richmond, Virginia, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Head to our website to see some pictures John took while he was in Richmond. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. And by the Duke Executive MBA, developing leaders and accelerating careers around the world with 4 top-ranked executive MBA programs for working professionals. DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, Zimbabwe's government reported today inflation there is running at 1,594% a year. Just to put that into context, it's a bit more than 2% a year over here. Shop owners expect inflation will soon get so bad, prices will have to increase hourly to keep up. Unemployment's pretty bad, too. More than 70% of the population doesn't have a job. President Robert Mugabe's policies are generally blamed for the state of the Zimbabwean economy, but his supporters do still love him. They're said to be spending $1.2 million for his 83rd birthday party. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 102 points, 0.8%. GM and Alcoa were the names in the news. The NASDAQ picked up 9 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 rose 10 points. That's about 0.75%. Thanks to Brian Watt and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, what happens when you mix business with pleasure?
It's probably either going to work out terrifically or be a colossal calamity. It intertwines your life in a way that is much more deep than it ever had been before.
Oh, well, that's good to know. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.